Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Ben. I am delighted to have you today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have just spent about 15 minutes catching up, figuring out who we're connected to and why we connected and perhaps where our paths crossed in our past. I think you and I have been sharing the same professional space and for probably 20 years, and this is the first meaningful conversation we've ever had.
Absolutely.
Interestingly, but it sounds like we might go in some pretty exciting directions from here on out. Ben, before we dive into our topic of conversation, how about we just let you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. I really honor Jason to be part of this. As you mentioned, I remember reading you back when we actually read blogs and commented. Yeah. And
I'm trying to remember what blog that might have been. But
following you and others, you know, through that process, and it's great to see that contribution still there. So it is really truly an honor to be on the podcast with you. So I lead an organization called Velocity, and the way I like to describe it is we work with ambitious leaders to really help them go farther than they ever imagined and faster than they ever thought possible by integrating technology, data, and execution strategies that really create a culture of learning, to use your words, so they can be responsive and ultimately create that full funnel accountability, eliminate the friction, and really maximize their impact. So my vision for Velocity was really born out of the idea that I've spent nearly 18 years in corporate settings, solving problems no one thought could be solved, tackling challenges no one thought were possible, and overcoming objections and obstacles that everyone thought were just going to be impenetrable. And in that process, what I really wanted and desired was a strategic collaborator. At least that's the word I use now. But all that was available to me were some really smart people who could tell me things that I knew were true, but my team had complete inability to take action on, or agencies who had a menu of 10 or 12 items that they could do exceptionally well, but I wasn't sure any single one of those was actually going to be a fit. So how, in fact, do we create a framework by which we can get really clear around current reality, which, by the way, and I want to talk to you about this, is a very difficult thing to do, particularly at the leadership team level. I call it herding tigers. You know, and then once you get them all looking in the same direction, how in fact do we define what success is? Not we want to grow, we want to do more good, but when we achieve it, how will we know that it's a win? And then how do we create these interdisciplinary, interdependent teams that live on the edge of the organization so they don't disrupt normal flows, but allow us to learn from each other and to learn from those we're trying to connect with, so that when we find new insights, we can then determine how do we repeat, measure, and scale those, and then integrate them back into core operations so that we're constantly adapting to ever-changing conditions. So it is a wonderful time to be in Velocity in the midst of a post-COVID environment. Started in the spring of 2019, and I really needed every person I talked to identify two characteristics. Did they believe there was a need to change? And where were they on the spectrum of desire or urgency to change? Well, March 2020, I did not need to ask the question, do you believe that change is necessary? I just needed to know, which direction did you head? Did you go hunker over in a corner, hoping that the storm will pass? Or did you go, finally, I'm jumping off the side of this mountain and let's see what happens? And so it has been like being tied to a rocket ship. And I'm honestly, for a data guy, a tech guy, a change guy, I am absolutely loving this season of leadership.
Yeah. So that's what you said before we hit the record button. The idea that, and all of us will remember less than a year ago, I think I was in Boston. I was up in Boston for a case conference, March 13th, Friday the 13th, when sort of COVID had come into the country. You know, it was officially on U.S. soil for a while. We had long figured out it was with us. It was in our midst. And the world was sort of changing. And in this particular case, this case conference had just basically been canceled. And I was like one of like 10 people in this huge, extraordinary hotel that couldn't change my plans. So I was still there. But before we hit the record button, Ben, you made a comment that sort of alluded to the idea that now we can finally be all of, you know, a lot of us who have been sort of anticipating these moments when the world was going to effectively change. And all these platforms, like even like the simple platform we're communicating on right now, having a really meaningful conversation and creating value for ourselves and others. Now we can actually do things the way that we perhaps wanted to for quite some time. I mean, isn't that the excitement that I'm hearing in between the lines of what you're saying to me just here in this introduction?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in March of 2020, the rest of the world caught up with us. I think about my frame of reference, and this is yours too. I have never known a time in professional life when video conferencing was not an acceptable way to, you know, do commerce, do business. Starting in software sales, I would sell, you know, six-figure payroll HR and time and attendance deals to transportation and manufacturing companies and never meet the CFO. Now, that was in the early 2000s. It wasn't near as smooth as it is today. You still had to pay a Microsoft engineer of Microsoft Live Meeting to sit on the call. You had to pay per seat, so it better be a qualified lead, as my sales manager used to say. But it was possible. You know, the other thing is I was handed a book in college by a guy named Tom Peters, you know, the management guru, called The Brand You, Y-O-U, exclamation point. And basically, he makes the argument in there that all work is temporary. And this is pre-social media, pre all of the things that we know today. And he basically says that, you know, you have skills and time that you're trading for projects and money. And when those two things, you and the organization, how you do that is mutually beneficial. In other words, you're creating mutual economic improvement and value for each other, then it works. And when it stops, then it needs to change. And he uses that as the basis to really introduce the idea of this temporary nature of work, which I think is really the base of our ideas today when we talk about dynamic teams. And then you think about like what Google does and the fact that they form teams with a timestamp on them. So 3 years, every 3 years, they bust them up and reassemble them. And how would that change executive teams, leadership teams, all of the teams in our organizations, if we, no matter what, success or failure, we reshuffled the deck and re-cross-pollinated that failure and that success across the organization. And then I think the other part of it is, you know, we came of age in a time where information was available to us, both in the kind of that traditional classroom setting, but also in a digital setting, right? Yeah. You know, for those of us that still remember, you know, Google Reader, rest in peace. You know, we loved collecting those RSS feeds. And when we spent, you know, we found ways to make it efficient to constantly expose ourselves to new ideas. This is how we framed our work and our professional life, is the assumption that we don't know everything, and the assumption that whatever we're doing is changing and evolving. So therefore, we need to constantly be exposed to ideas. Guess what happened in March of 2020? Everybody thought, video conferencing sounds like a pretty good idea. Probably our only chance. This whole idea that work is temporary became very visceral, right? We felt it in our guts. You know, will we continue to survive? Will we continue to work? We saw teams reshape. You know, I talked to somebody last week. They're working with people in their organization they've never met, manager they've never heard from, working on projects that they were never even aware existed. This is the world that we live in, right? And then this whole idea of persistent online drip style education, books, blogs, YouTube videos, all of that being available online. You know, still trying to convince my dad that if he has a question, he can go to YouTube and probably find a plethora of videos to answer that question. It's the jury's still out in his mind.
Yeah.
But with my kids, I don't have to explain that to them, right? They're going to, if I ask them a question, they're going to send me a YouTube video. And so it's so wild to think how much of an oddball I felt, right? You know, you and I probably had the experience. We're meeting with the executive team. There's 15 people around the table. We're on the 80-inch screen at the end of the room. They've got two conference tables, microphones. You know, one of them doesn't work. And you can't hear what the other guy's saying because it's coming in and out of. And they're like, I wish you were just here.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, the idea that we would, you know, that somebody would pay us to get on a plane and stay in a hotel and take 3 days, depending on where it was, to go through that process rather than just, you know, hit the and join the call and deal with what's in front of us. It's just been wild to watch that become normal and recognize, you know, even, I mean, I've been on a crusade since the mid 2000s to get rid of file attachments, literally a crusade. Like if that were a legitimate nonprofit endeavor, I'd probably do it because I mean, death to the email attachment, you know, death by file versioning. And so just watching everybody really come into all of the things that make it possible for us to do asynchronous, non-geographic specific, non-location dependent work is really remarkable. So I finally feel like the world caught up with us.
So, okay. So I've been reading a book. I'm working on my second book project right now. And I read a book. I started reading it probably about this time last year, probably even before COVID became a reality, written by a guy, Cooper, Ramo is his last name. The name of the book is The Seventh Sense. And what he's talking about is that the idea that our world is now connected by networks and that there's power and capability in these networks, that if you don't have this seventh sense, sort of like the sixth sense that was written about during the Industrial Revolution, if you didn't understand, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, what industrialization meant to our economy and our society, if you didn't understand that, you were basically going to get left behind. And what he's talking about now is that if you don't understand the power of networks, and by networks, essentially what is enabling everything that you're talking about and what has enabled a lot of us to continue to thrive and perhaps even grow in the midst of COVID-19 for the last year is the power and capability of networks. It's the connectedness. It's what it's what a lot of authors are talking about. It's the hyperconnectivity in our world that we oftentimes assume to be, and I think this is some of what's in between the lines of what you're getting at here. And I think it's particularly relevant for a lot of us who are perhaps haven't developed the intuition that Ramo is talking about in his book. It's more than just what this author is talking about. It's more than just simply the practical efficiencies that come with being connected. It's an underlying way of thinking, and therefore designing experiences and designing companies and thinking about the way that we're going to engage with the world that is just simply not. There's another author or group of authors that I don't think I have found a published book on the subject, but it's this idea of creating perceived proximity. You know, you and I are benefiting right now. The more we interact on this platform, for example, the more we're going to create the perception or what is now going to be a new definition of proximity. And so when it comes to a lot of my guests on the podcast, a lot of my listeners on the podcast, they're thinking, and what concerns me the most, Ben, and I want you to talk about this in light of what you're saying. I think there's organizations out there that are missing the fact that even in an era of more social distancing, you've still got to be closer than ever to the people that are going to be the most generous to who you are, to your organization. Now is not the time to distance yourself because of social distancing reasons, but now is actually the time to learn how to actually increase proximity and use the power of networks to do that.
So I actually think we're living in the philosophical end of the industrial age.
Yes, that's what this, yes, exactly.
So, yeah. So, you know, you had the agrarian economy, right? Where you had deep-seated relationships with providers, vendors, communities. You know, there was a shared, you know, shared understanding between grocers and farmers and butchers and blacksmiths and all of that type of stuff. All of that went away in the Industrial Revolution. And then really post-World War II, we built out the economy based on what our experience was in the military. And I'm not saying that as a moral indicator of good or bad. There were a lot of great things that happened. But if you look at most of management thinking in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it was largely driven because the military raised through over 4 years a generation of thinkers or people, you know, in order to think, believe, and act in particular ways. And so we saw that, you know, really, really flourish. And it really, I think a lot, you know, really detracted from our understanding and appreciation of networks because we allowed corporations to be able to do that for us. So much to the point that we saw the rise of what we now call human resources. And I actually think talking about humans as resources is one of the most dehumanizing things that we could do.
Right, right. Yeah.
And by fact, human resources existed to protect the company from the employee. Yeah, I mean, this is the genesis of it, right? And we're seeing some great moves in people operations and that. And I have wonderful friends in the human resources area. So there certainly it's somewhat of an oversimplification, but that was the beginning of all of that. And so we had a very militarized culture that brought that to their work post-military. Then you have, 2001 that happens, right? 9/11.
Yeah.
And in the process of that, we saw, I mean, I grew up in Houston, so I saw Arthur Anderson and Enron completely disappear. And these were immovable objects, right? And so that introduced Sarbanes-Oxley and kind of the age of over-regulation, particularly of publicly traded companies, that trickled into nonprofit work.
Yeah, totally did.
That was right. The rise of what I call risk manager and the compliance officer into the C-suite. This is when we saw the C-suite infiltrated with attorneys and accountants, and God love both of them, but they don't like risk. And just like they learned in the industrial management world, they figured out how to manage these organizations to eliminate the risk. Well, guess what? You cannot be fast, flat, flexible if you are concerned about and your primary goal is to eliminate the variables and the element of surprise. Sorry, you can't have both.
Yeah.
So we're now two decades into, an overly regulated system that has tried to eliminate all risk. And COVID hits. And what COVID does is it takes every constant in your equation and makes it a variable.
Yeah.
And so every fiber of the being of most people in C-suite positions today. At least one person on your C-suite team, no matter how large or small, is a compliance officer and a risk manager by definition and by nature. When you throw all of those constants into variables, it literally sends that individual into convulsions. And so the market, I mean, it is, they don't know what to do. They've stressed out to the point, right? And this is where all of a sudden you can't buy a ream of paper until that, you know, purchase order goes through the CFO. I mean, this is the world that we're living in, the response mechanisms that we're living in. And so what actually COVID has done is it reveals the fact that how we were running organizations was very balance sheet centric, but not marketplace centric. And so we now all of a sudden have been exposed to the reality that the donor, constituent, client, the lowest common denominator is the one who is the primary asset. And because technology and data have advanced to the point, we can actually be, in your word, responsive with the marketplace, which means the need for the actual business is much less because the needs are, that cause a product to exist might change over time. So how we develop products and we introduce design thinking and other things where we bring the market and the creators together and we create something that's really that solves the jobs to be done. You know, jobs theory.
Let's dive into that notion of risk for a minute, because I think what I have observed, and I've been watching the I'm not going to name names and I'm not going to be too specific about this. But what I tend to see in our work right now, I think if we dive into that issue of risk as it relates to fundraising and as it relates to the nonprofit in particular, it kind of aligns with this notion that sort of simmers in my head every once in a while, that we hide behind ethics, that we're always sort of conjuring up these ethical reasons to not really go at the pace or take on these risks with which you're talking about. And so, and how does this get back to this notion of networks and the connectivity that we have? I mean, isn't the reality of the world that we live in now that if I get into a place where I'm in an unethical situation, like with a guy like Ben, you and I are having this is going in the wrong direction, right? Well, shoot, the benefit of a network is I can unplug the network. I can just hit the stop button, right? if this is just not working out. And so I don't know if I think the ethics are going to change, because I started to run into this a lot when I started pushing out the messaging in my first book. I got a lot of pushback in sort of this ethical context. They weren't saying that what I was saying was unethical. It was just that they were afraid. There was this notion that to be more engaged more consistently with a greater number of people was going to stir up all these ethical dilemmas. And I was like, no, what it's actually going to do is it's actually going to sort of soften the blow on the chance that you've overly invested in too few people. You know, I mean, you think about what happened with Enron. The reason Enron was so disastrous is because so many people were betting on the same shop. They weren't sort of spreading the risk. I remember that on the news, just like you do, the number of employees sort of flowing out of that extraordinary building in downtown Houston. It's because all that risk was being put on essentially the lap of one individual or a small group of individuals. Shoot, in this era of networks now, I can spread my risk over extraordinary numbers of people. Ethics is always going to be there, but isn't ethics in this era of connectivity going to essentially, it's a different type of ethic, isn't it?
So this is what's so one of the most difficult and complex contrasts between a for-profit and a nonprofit setting. In a for-profit setting, you really are driving toward, you know, revenue goals, margin, EBITDA, those kinds of things that really kind of live above what I call cultural permission systems. In the nonprofit world, we tend to like to create safety. And the way that we create safety is this ethics conversation, which I like to call cultural permission systems.
Okay.
And I'm not advocating situational ethics. There certainly is a definition of right and wrong. But what we often call ethics means that it is really another way of saying cultural permission systems. What do I think is appropriate way for us to act and react. I have never gotten in more trouble at the leadership table than trying to advocate for the donor. And I know that seems absolutely ridiculous. But when the donor's intent doesn't match the cultural permission systems of the organization, the donor, by definition of the organization, is wrong or is less valuable.
Yeah.
And so who are we? And we really believe as fundraisers that we are, you know, our primary goal is to meet the donor in the midst of that intersection of desire and intent and help them accomplish what's most important to them. Why can't we as organizations be in a collaborative relationship where we can co-create? This happens in the for-profit world all the time. But in the nonprofit world, we don't like it if it doesn't look like the types of things that we find are most appropriate. I see this most often in the conversation and at its base level in the feelings around restricted and unrestricted giving. You know, there's immense pressure being put on major gift teams to raise more money for unrestricted giving.
Yeah.
Around unrestricted giving.
Yeah.
And that by definition is just at friction with where major donors are, who they are, where they are in the organization. It doesn't mean that they don't give to the organization itself. But if you want to move a major donor to a transformational donor, it's not going to be because they have so much love and affection for the organization that they just want to give without accountability. And that's essentially in that case. But if we don't believe that unrestricted gifts are valued at the same level that restricted gifts are, then we are fundamentally making a, you know, deciding a cultural permission system, establishing a cultural permission system, and making a rank that that gift isn't as good. But what we really did is we inspired the donor to have a dynamic conversation with us that led them to take an action. Holy cow, we should be celebrating that. Yeah. And we should do what we need to do and evaluate that. Now, sometimes that means, hey, sorry, we can't accomplish that for you, but let me connect you with somebody who can. That also happens in the business world. But there's something in the nonprofit space that when we don't understand it, when we're uncomfortable with it, we hide behind it. Get into the ministry, faith-based space. Jason, all hands are off. Man. That's not what God told me. What I believe to be true. And you know what? When I have tried to have those conversations, I call it the God card. When the God card enters the room, and I sound like I'm completely sacrilegious here. But when the God card enters the room, the conversation is over. Like, what do you say? Well, God just does tell me that's not true.
Right. Okay, so if you go between the lines, everything you're saying, I'm trying to pull out between the lines because I want my listeners to really get exactly what you're saying. You're also talking, so we're not only just talking about ethics and connectivity and networks and the way that the world has changed in the last 12 months. And it hasn't really changed so much in the last 12 months. It's just actually been able to do what it's been setting itself up to do for quite some time. But you're also changing, are we not changing the definition of expertise? Because what the expert is in accordance with this, I love your phrase, cultural permission systems. Expertise was defined, whether you're in the for-profit, nonprofit, or otherwise, was defined in accordance with that permission system. Once that permission system sort of goes out the window, or once that permission system just evolves, once ethics change, once the rules, once the what this author in this book, Seven Sense, would be talking about, once essentially the framework that you're existing in has changed, everything else has to change with it. And that means the job descriptions change. What it is your profession has changed. You just don't take who Ben and Jason happen to have been 15 months ago and just plug us into this new paradigm. We're going to have to adapt, evolve, and change with it.
Oh man. Yeah. That's my jam right there. You are all up in my grill on that. So, I mean, that is exactly where I think we need to be having those conversations. I saw a management journal. I'm not going to reveal who it is, but it was one of the key ones that's out there, actually published an article that suggests that the job description is dead and that our approach to jobs as we understand them today, defined roles with specific tasks and priorities that are in perpetuity, is over. Yeah.
Yeah.
That idea that it's about teams, shared outcomes, and not individual performance as the primary means of success is there. So we are already having that conversation at the philosophical level. It's just going to take some time to come down to it. And I have said that the greatest inhibitor of future success is past success. This is very true at the leadership team level. What got you to that role was your ability to make really good decisions and produce really good results. What is not being acknowledged right now is the assumptions, the system, the environment in which those decisions were good decisions may no longer be true. So this is where I really like what how the book, How Google Works, describes the phrase, the smart creative. So think about Google, right? They are a technical company, engineering company. They get to hire the best and the brightest. They do not hire specialists. I can't say that enough.
Right.
They hire generalists.
Yes.
Because specialists have already made up their mind what is right, wrong, true, and not, and how to do certain things. Ever met those people? I have. And there's one way to do it. And if you don't do it that way, it's not going to happen. Add into that in a nonprofit setting, we've all met those people. This is how you do it. And if you don't do it that way, it's over. So they take these smart creatives because they want them to be constantly curious. So your notion that expertise has shifted, exactly true.
Yeah.
Our expertise has to be in how do we work with people? How do we understand what the donor is telling us constantly, not just one time, through multiple channels? How do we appreciate lifetime value? And how do we drive toward a culture of learning? Where it's about the process of discovery and understanding and testing, not about the championing precision and execution and repetition. And I think that is the single biggest inhibitor going forward. So I even suggest, in my work that we, philosophically, this is what I take leadership teams through, is like, what if we disbanded all of your departments today? I didn't say fire everybody, but what if we disbanded them?
The structure, right. Get rid of the structure. Yeah.
Yeah. Reorganize them around different waypoints along the donor journey.
Yeah.
Or maybe even portfolios of donors around it, so that we didn't have, if you talk to a direct mail person, all they need is more direct mail. Like, we're going to hit the number. We just need more direct mail. Same with email, same with social media. When in fact, we need to be asking the question, what does a donor at this stage look like? What types of communication actually drive them to make the behavior decision? And how are we seeing the progression of that through early, mid, and late stage attributes that would suggest that we are working together to create a 360 degree experience that's driving that donor to a point in which they're going to stay with us for a long time. This is something that, this is where I love Roger Craver's work around retention fundraising, is that he actually makes the case in there that if you want to raise money in times of change, grow your giving from your existing base. Doesn't mean you stop acquiring, but you don't know who you're acquiring, when you're acquiring, how they're going to be acquired, and what they're going to do after they're acquired.
Yeah.
And I would say that's true in this environment as well. We're in the decade of disruption. What we just experienced was a big bang, and it's going to take 10 years to start to settle that out. And when it's all settled, it's not going to be an endpoint, but it's going to be a constant shifting of sand, if you will. And so the only hope that we have is to organize our organizations around the donor and ensure that we're designing experiences that match jobs theory, what they hired us to do, and that continue to reinforce why they are lending their credibility, their brand, their desire to have significance to our organization. And I think it's going to be a constant, just an overwhelming tidal wave of learning that's going to ask us to change, shift, adapt. So rather than thinking about leadership teams and executive teams as 20-year, 30-year, 10-year, what if we looked at them in 3-year segments or 5-year segments? So, and then we ask the question, do we need the same group again?
So we only hold on to our listeners for about a half hour, but I got to get you to go a little deeper on this one. But I think everything that we're talking about, some of the stuff you're reading, I'm reading, what we're actually hearing is if you want to work, if you're a baby boomer right now in the nonprofit sector, for-profit sector, wherever you're at in the economy, if you want to work for another 5 or 10 years, you're doing as much learning and perhaps more learning than even guys like you and I who 10, 15, 20 years ago, when we were really getting into the early parts of our career, were basically being told your job is learning. You're in a constant mode of learning. I mean, the way you were talking about blogging and everything that we sort of did, or, I mean, like right at the beginning when I started really working for a shop, really being on a payroll, I immediately sort of began to immerse myself in a learning posture like you were talking about. Some of our supervisors are more tenured among us. They never leaned into that. And now the world has evolved in such a way where that's just all that there is. Yeah. You know the industrial way, sort of that hierarchical military oriented sort of way of thinking that's sort of gone out the window now. I don't think it's coming back. I don't think we're going to get that back. Am I right?
Oh, 100%. No, the world has shifted, and it's not going to let us go back. When the biggest thing is, we need leaders to reconcile and kind of mourn the fact that. For those who need to. Now, I don't want to give the impression there are a ton of leaders that I'm talking to that have been that have found business as usual unacceptable. And they are looking at COVID as the opportunity to lean in and create dynamic change. But they've been living in organizations that have resisted that change.
Yeah.
And I always say in change management, never underestimate the personality of the organization and the organization's willingness to expel anything that it considers a threat. So there are, but what leaders need to do, all leaders need to do, is reconcile that whatever they thought was normal is not normal anymore.
Right.
And instead of, they have to resist and retrain their thinking, because there's so much pressure put on leaders to have the answer, to know what to do next and to deliver on results. And instead, they need to create learning environments where they're sending themselves back to school and realize that they may never have the best idea in the room ever again, no matter what they've seen.
Yeah.
But if they can expose themselves to pockets of people who are doing things in new ways, they may be able to create synthesis of ideas that leads to that. But even whatever conclusion they come to is temporary. And so whatever we need to do to reconcile with that, there's an awareness phase, then there's the grief stage, right? Then there's the mourning stage. Then we come out on the other side of it and realize we need each other more than we've ever needed each other. This idea that one person's going to have all the ideas, let's just set that aside, take ourselves off the hook for that and recognize that we're all coming at this in new ways. If we can get in that posture, I actually think we have some unbelievably fantastic leaders positioned to do that. They're just not finally attuned yet to how things have changed. But when they start realizing that data can be something they can consume every day and can make new decisions based on new information every day,
yeah,
that it doesn't just have to describe what's already happened, when they can take massive amounts of data and realize that they can fairly accurately project forward what's going to happen and how they can respond and how they can reallocate resources and time and money and people, I think they're going to find it to be very empowering. But that we've got to renegotiate cultural permission systems and look at the leader of the future is going to start with who do I need? And then what do I need to learn in this process? And then those two things are going to color the work that needs to be done, recognizing that is just a contextual byproduct of the other two realities. But if I have a really great team and I'm really staying anchored and connected in a responsive relationship with the marketplace or our donor base, I have all the confidence in the world that we're going to continue to pivot because we're anchored in the right ways.
Ben, this has been a fascinating conversation. As you well know, I've got somebody in the waiting room waiting to begin a second conversation. Nice. That's a first. This beautiful Riverside platform also has a waiting room that I have chosen not to use. and I guess I need to learn how to use it. So
the more the merrier, man. I love it, man. I'm so thankful that you listened. I mean, these are the things that my wife gets, you know, rolls her eyes from me talking about ad nauseum with her. And, you know, one of the byproducts of being at home more and not traveling as much. So I love connecting with really smart people who are really pushing the edges of where we need to be thinking. And I firmly believe that we're going to see nonprofits do things that we've never seen them do before, considered that was possible. We just simply need to let go of the artificial constraints and lean into the fact of networks and data and technology allow us to scale and measure solutions so that we can be more confident in our program efficiency, more, you know, you have even greater conviction about our potential to make that impact and be able to move forward with a level of excitement that I hope we all bring to the work that we're doing.
Ben, if somebody's listening to us today, they know how to find me. They may not know how to find you. How would you suggest that they do that?
Yeah. So you can check me out on your favorite podcast platform. Look for The Velocity Factor, or you can simply go to thevelocityfactor.com. And that's going to take you to a sign up form for a weekly newsletter. I promise I only send the good stuff. And it is all about working through these crazy ideas. So if you want to peek in my mind on a drip basis, that's the place to go. If you want to find out more about the work that I'm doing with leaders around digital transformation and change management and how that's driving cultures of learning, then check out velocitystrategysolutions.com. And when you hit there, you'll be able to get a free copy of my book, Master the Pivot. And it's really talking about how do we frame, focus, and grow in ways that create accountability, eliminate friction, and maximize that impact. So, and then of course I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter. Those are probably where I spend most of my time, but occasionally you can find me on Facebook and Instagram.
All right, buddy. It has been a pleasure. You're always welcome back. Thanks again, Ben. We'll put all your contact information in the show notes. You have a wonderful day and stay safe.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.